How many people were here last week?
What was that?
Like half of us. We did Height to Ego.
Like, was I here?
That's a totally legitimate question.
Was I here? Yeah, sure I was.
We did Height to Ego. Were you here for Height to Ego? The Sin of the Calf?
No.
Oh, I was.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, if you recall, I did say we were going to continue with it, but from a different angle. So if you missed last week, you're not going to be confused today because we're talking about it completely from a different perspective. But we're going to just review what we talked about last week for a couple minutes, just so in case we touch on it today, people will know what we're referring to. Okay, so what we spoke about last week, you were really dealing with the question of what were Bnei Israel doing when they did this sin? Did they think they were doing idol worship? Did they think it was an idol worship? What was their intention? And we saw lots of different approaches in the commentaries in terms of what exactly was going on in their heads, I would say. So the first that approach we saw was from Rashi, which we also saw in Midrash, and also really is, if you read the pshat, sounds like what was going on, which was that it really was an idol. They were trying to worship an idol, which could make sense given that they were coming from a culture of idol worship. It would be their natural default to sort of regress back to idol worship when they got nervous that something was going wrong when Moshe didn't come down from the mountain. The second approach that we saw was from the Ramban, but we didn't see any of these inside. We also spoke about how Ibn Ezra and the Chizkuni and Rav Hirsch also speak about this, which is this idea that they were not looking to replace Hashem. They weren't worshiping the calf as a god, but rather they were trying to create a new leader for themselves. They were trying to replace Moshe, and that they were feeling lost without their leader, and so they were trying to deal with that issue by making sure that they had a leader in place, and that was what the calf was supposed to represent. And then the third approach we saw was from the Kuzari, where he spoke about how they were not intending to worship the calf as an idol. They were worshiping Hashem, but because they came from a culture of idol worship, their default was to use something physical to connect to God, as opposed to having an only spiritual relationship. They felt that physicality was the way to kind of get to God, and so they needed something physical to attach themselves to, and so they created this idol, but it wasn't for the purpose of serving the idol as a god that would be separate from Hashem, but rather it would be a way to connect to God himself. Okay, so that was the Kuzari, and he spoke about the idea of physical objects in Judaism, and how even though we think of ourselves as a religion that is only about spiritual worship, there are physical objects in Judaism within the Mishkan. There are many physical things. We have the Kruvim, these like angelic sort of creatures that are made on top of the Aron, on top of the Ark where the tablets were kept. And he says that as long as Hashem commands it and it's sanctioned by God, then it's a good thing. It's a mitzvah. It's positive. It's a good way to connect to God. But if we go about and do it ourselves, that's when it becomes an issue. And that was what the problem was with the Egel. It wasn't that they were worshiping an idol, but because God didn't tell them to build this Egel, therefore they were not supposed to build it. Okay? Any questions up till this point? The fourth approach that we spoke about was from Dina Freundlich, who is a teacher at Midrash at Lindenbaum, and she spoke about this idea that perhaps it was idol worship, perhaps it wasn't quite idol worship, but what was the real reason why they ended up in this situation was because they were not emotionally ready for the burden of Matan Torah, and they had just committed to something so massive, they didn't know how to handle it, and so they sort of like self-sabotaged their relationship because they just didn't know what else to do. They just freaked out, did this thing, and then ultimately go to regret it, because when Hashem says later, after he forgives them, but he says he's going to send an angel in their place, they go into mourning, and that sort of shows that this idea of just like a human relationship where intimacy and closeness means vulnerability, and that's a scary thing, and so some people might avoid relationships, but ultimately they end up in a state of loneliness, whereas if you are willing to sort of put yourself out there and open yourself up a little bit and engage in relationships, you ultimately do have the joy of that closeness that comes from that, but it is a scary thing to do, and we sort of spoke about that comparison for the Jewish people with Hashem, as we see with human relationships. Anybody have any questions? Clear? Good? All right. Okay, so that was last week. So what we kept on touching on last week many times, but we didn't go into in depth, was the question of Aharon and his role in this whole episode. So what I'd like to do is read the psukim again. We'll skip, last time we literally read the whole thing, the whole chapter from beginning to end. We will skip a little bit more this time, but just to pay attention in the text to see how Aharon is depicted, and then we'll see a couple of different approaches from different commentaries in terms of what exactly they understand Aharon's role to be. Okay, so if you look at right at the beginning, sorry, you need to open up in your Chumash. I apologize. I did not give you this on the source sheet. This is chapter 32, Lamed Bet, verse 1. So if anybody has it in the blue Chumash, can you tell us what page you're on?
The big one, I'm on 493.
The small one and the big one are the same pages. Okay, so it's Shemot Lamed Bet, mm-hmm. Shemot 32.
493.
Okay, so I will read in Hebrew and sort of translate as I go, and I'll tell you what verse I'm up to. Feel free to follow along in either the English or the Hebrew. Okay, so in verse 1 it says, V'yar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe laredet. The nation saw that Moshe was sort of tarrying and coming down, minahar, from the mountain. V'yikahel ha'am al Aharon, and they sort of gathered upon Aharon. V'yamru elav, and they said to him, Kum asel anu Elohim asher yalchu lafaninu, ki ze Moshe ha'ish, asher he'elanu me'eretz Mitzrayim, lo yadanu mehayalo. So they come and they gather around Aharon, and they say to him, Get up and make us a god that will walk before us. Because this Moshe, this man who brought us out of Mitzrayim, we don't know what happened to him. Right? Is everybody okay? Okay. Verse 2. V'yomer aleihem Aharon. And Aharon says to them, Parku nizmei hazahav, asher ba'oznei nesheichem b'neichem uvnoteichem v'hiviu olai. So he says, go and get all the gold jewelry, right, the earrings, of your wives and children and your sons and daughters, and bring them to me. And then in Gimel it says, in verse 3, V'yit parku kolam et nizmei hazahav asher ba'oznehem. And the nation went and removed all of the earrings that were on their ears. V'yuviu el Aharon. And they bring it to Aharon. Okay? V'yikach mi'adam. And he takes it from their hands. V'yitzaro to bacheret. And he fashioned it with, we're just going to say cheret for now. We'll see Rashi has two different explanations of this word. V'yaseu egel masecha. And he made it into this molten calf. V'yamru Ela Elohecha Yisrael, and the people said, "This is your God Israel, Asher Ha'elucham Eretz Yisrael, that took you out of the land of Egypt." V'yar Aharon, and Aharon saw, Vayiven Mizbeach, and he built an altar. Lefanav V'yikra Aharon, and he's called out. V'yomar Chag LaHashem Machar, and he said, "Tomorrow there will be a holiday for God." V'yashkimu Mimacharad, and they got up the next morning early. V'ya'alu Alot V'yigashu Shlemim, so they bring sacrifices. V'yashev Ha'am Le'echol V'shatu, they sat down to eat and drink. V'yakumu Letzachek, and they got up to be sort of, what was the word we used last week?
Rebel.
They were inappropriate, let's say. Okay, they were dancing, playing, doing something maybe sexually inappropriate. We're not really sure exactly what that was about. Okay, so that's the first thing. So then we get to the episode of, now Moshe, it's like, you know, screen, like new scene. Moshe's up on top of the mountain. Hashem tells him what's going on. Moshe begs Hashem not to overreact. And then Moshe comes down. Moshe sees what's happening. He throws the tablets down onto the ground, right? And then Moshe is going to approach Aharon, right? And say to him, what's going on here? So if you jump ahead to verse 21, Chaf Aleph. V'yomer Moshe el Aharon. Moshe says to Aharon, Me asalacha ha'am hazeh, ki heveta alav chata'a gdola. So Moshe says to Aharon, what did this nation do to you? Because you've brought upon it a big sin, a big mistaken sin, you could probably call it. V'yomer Aharon, and Aharon says to him, Al yichar af adoni, atayadata et ha'am, ki verahu. You know this nation, and they are in evil. What does the English translation say there?
Disposed towards evil.
Okay. V'yomru li, and they said to me, Asel anu Elohim asher yalchu lefaninu. Make for us a God that will walk before us. Make for us gods that will walk before us. Ki ze Moshe ha'ish asher he'elanu me'eretz Mitzrayim. Because this man Moshe, who took us out of Egypt, lo yadanu mehayelo. We don't know what happened to him. V'amar lahem, lemizahav hitparku v'yitnu li. And I said, whoever has gold, take it off and give it to me. V'eshalchehu ba'esh v'yitzei ha'egel hazeh. And I'll throw it in the fire, and I threw it in the fire, and out came this egel. V'yar Moshe et ha'am kiparuhu. And Moshe saw that the nation was sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, wild or out of control. Kiparao Aharon l'shimtza b'kamehem. Because Aharon basically allowed them to become out of control. Okay, and then the very final verse of the chapter says, Lamed Hey 35, V'yigof Hashem et ha'am, and Hashem sent this plague on the nation, Al Asher Asu et ha'egel, because they made this egel, Asher Asa Aharon, which Aharon did, or made. Okay, so, what are some things that you notice from these, we'll call it two different accounts. We have like the account of the Torah in real time, and then Aharon's description of events to Moshe when Moshe arrives. What did you notice?
Well, one thing is he makes it seem like the calf just appeared.
Okay, good.
Aviv, you're going to...
Aharon is being blamed?
Yeah, it seems like he...
By the Psukim?
Yeah.
He allowed this to happen. He was left in charge, just like you leave your kids with the babysitter and you come home and the whole house is messed up, like the babysitter should be held accountable, right? Should be. So I don't know if they really will. So Aharon is being blamed. There's an inconsistency, it would seem, from the way that the Psukim describe it to how Aharon describes it in terms of how exactly this egel was made, right? In the first instance, it sounds like Aharon fashioned the egel himself. And in the second time, makes it sound like it just appeared. It just showed up here. Like, I don't know how this happened, right? So any other points anybody wants to make? Yeah.
In the Torah's account, Aharon is very specific to them about what gold they should go get, like really giving them exact directions. And in his account to Moshe, he just says, like, who has gold? And it just seems like a lot less involved, a lot less.
Right. Okay, good. So I didn't see any Mefarshim who really picked up on that point. I did notice it too. It could just be because he's summarizing. I was joking with my friend the other day. My daughter like does not know how to summarize anything, which will tell me a story. Like I'll be like, what happened at school today? And it's like a 7-hour recount of every moment of the day. And I'm like, just the key points. So that's could be Aharon's just good at summarizing. But if you look carefully at the first account, pay very close attention to the instruction Aharon gives them and what the people do. Okay, we're right at the beginning of the chapter again. What is the difference between what Aharon says and what the people do?
Your wives, sons, and daughters versus the entire people.
Okay.
I don't know.
So I don't know if it means entire people when it says that they did it. The Midrash says that this was all done by men, right? That the women were not involved in this sin. So it sounds like Aharon, and we're going to see this in Rashi, Aharon says to them, go ask your wives and your sons and your daughters for their jewelry. And the men make a decision that instead of asking their wives and sons and daughters, or maybe they do ask and get a bad answer, they're just going to give up their own jewelry. So this is one of the things that the Mefarshim pick up on, that perhaps Aharon had some sort of strategy in mind. That he wasn't just going along with things, but that he really had some kind of plan about how he was going to try to prevent this from happening. And whether or not his plan came to fruition is a separate issue. But he did have some sort of idea in mind of how he was going to prevent this from happening. And maybe this is our first clue to seeing that something is going on here with what he was hoping they would do and what they ultimately did do.
Why do we think that?
Because it says the nation. It says the men. Basically, the way the Chazal read it is that it's the men. It should have said, and they went and got their wives jewelry, right? It doesn't say that. So the Chazal read that as being, it's right. Not them.
It says the entire people.
It says entire people in English there. I'm shocked that our scroll did that because they always use Rashi in their translation, and that's not what Rashi thinks. So I'm very, very interested to see that. The translation really is the nation.
It also says that.
Just sounds like everyone.
Right. But again, if we can't read this without, like, we can read it in Pshat and like be left with 100 million questions. But what I'll point out to you later is that the Mefarshim who don't like to use Midrash either use Midrash here or don't say a word. They just, Rashbam does not comment on this question because he doesn't know what to do. Because what's the big question? If Aharon is being held responsible, which the Psukim make it sound like the chapter ends off with being like, and by the way, this is Aharon's fault, right? Like it really sounds like the Torah is saying this is Aharon. Why doesn't he get punished? He's the Kohen Gadol. Like it's not like anything happens to him. Moshe doesn't seem to be holding him responsible. There doesn't seem to be any consequence that we see in the rest of his life, right? So the Mefarshim have that question, that if he was responsible, but his children did something.
But it's also a punishment for him.
Right.
Okay, it's possible, maybe. You would think that somebody who helped the entire nation fashion an idol would not then be the Kohen Gadol. Like, if I was God and I got to choose who my Kohen Gadol was, I wouldn't choose the one who made the calf, right? Like, there must be something going on here. That's the Mefarshim are seeing, that they're saying it must be that Aharon didn't do something so bad. Because if he did, the Torah would tell us that he did something so bad. And it's not saying that. So I think that that's what the Mefarshim are grappling with. So Rashbam just literally, like, he's silent. He doesn't say a word. And I think it's because he doesn't want to bring Midrashim, because he's not really into Midrashim in terms of his commentary. And so he's just, like, not touching it. But like Rav Hirsch, we're going to see later, he usually doesn't quote a lot of Midrashim, but he does quote the Midrashim here. He does use them to back himself up because he doesn't know where else to go with this. It's very hard to read this chapter without the influence of Chazal in order to understand it, I would say.
In the first account...
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah?
Go ahead.
he wrapped it in a cloth and fashioned the calf.
Okay, so that is a translation. We're going to see what is that in a minute, okay?
In the second, he says, I threw it into the fire.
I threw it in. Okay, good. Okay, so we're going to talk about that.
So you're saying that men wore jewelry?
Yes, it does sound that way. I mean, they were coming out of Egypt. If you think, if you look at the pictures of how the Egyptians...
So that if men wear jewelry today, mm-hmm. it's not a problem.
I don't know. It's a fair question. It's a fair question. 100%.
Ask your LR.
Yeah. Yeah. Rabbi Weinstock's in the office. You can stop in afterwards.
Thank you, local rabbi. Also, it's also to teach us that if you do something wrong, own up to it.
Because okay.
You, the punishment will be, if there's going
did
to
Aharon
be
wrong, own up to it?
Well, he said, I did it.
Did he? He said, I threw the gold in and the calf appeared. Oh. That's like when your daughter's like, I don't know how the marker got on the wall. It's just there, right? Did or did not happen last week. So, right?
No, I'm sorry.
And no, I did this and I shouldn't have. He doesn't say I did it. He says it appeared. That doesn't sound like he's, it's all, and, but the Maharal, we'll see the Maharal. Well, I didn't bring him, but I'll quote the Maharal for you soon. He doesn't agree with me on this one. He doesn't think that he's lying. But I don't think that if he's really taking responsibility, like really taking responsibility is like the story of Yehuda and Tamar, where he like says like, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong here, right? She forced the issue, but at that moment, he could have just stayed silent and had her killed, and nobody would have ever known whose things those were. And he decided at that moment to own up to his mistake. So, but he says, I think, I can't remember offhand, but I think he says something like, Tzadka mimeni, or something like that. It's something like very clear, like, you're right. Here he's not saying anything like that. He's saying this calf appeared. So I don't know if I would call that taking responsibility. Yeah.
But in Dalit it says that the people said, okay, this is your God. I guess they're speaking
to... The people
to,
said that, right.
I guess they're speaking to each other.
Right.
And then Aaron builds an altar and says a festival for Hashem. So if you're going with the theory of, I think what you said last week, that they weren't replacing God, it was like a conduit to reach God, maybe Aaron was like, okay, they got their little calf and now we could go back to serving Hashem.
Right.
Maybe he was still trying to go down that path, but then the people were like,
100%. So that's basically what Rav Hirsch says. Rav Hirsch basically says that Aaron had a whole plan in mind, and it just unraveled very, very quickly, and he couldn't get it back in control. And he was hoping to sort of delay them and hold things off and slow them down, and then they, you know, he thought, well, maybe if I tell them to go and ask their wives, it'll take a few hours, and Moshe will get here any minute now, so Moshe will get here before anything happens, and it sort of just kept going. And then, what does he say? When does he say the Chag LaHashem is?
Tomorrow.
He already built the Mizbeach. And they have the calf right there. Like, why are they waiting? He's trying to, like, push things off. He's hoping Moshe will get home tonight, right? Or maybe he's just trying to help. Maybe the excitement and the energy and the craziness, like, they'll wake up the next morning and they'll be like, oh my gosh, what did we do? They'll sort of, like, have this realization. I read something somewhere, I can't remember where it was from, that was saying maybe he was trying to shock them. Maybe he made this eagle so they would see it and they would go, oh my God, like, did we actually just do this? What were we thinking? Like, maybe he had all these ideas about how he was going to get them to stop doing what they were doing and he just couldn't get them to stop. And it says, what happens right after they make the Chag LaHashem? What he says, the Chag LaHashem Machar, and then it says they got up early the next morning. It was like the people couldn't wait. Like, he was hoping to push them up, but they were, like, up at dawn, ready to go, already bringing their sacrifices before he could stall the situation.
You
so
he would have run up the mountain in the middle of the night and been like, Moshe.
Right. Yeah.
Houston, we have a problem.
Interesting. Okay. Mayday. Okay. So let's look at the source sheet I gave you now, and we're going to sort of see some of these issues in the Mefarshim. I don't know how much we'll get through all of it. We can definitely summarize some because there is a lot going on here. Oh, I need this sheet, not this sheet. Okay, the first source I brought you is from the Gemara in Megillah. It's actually a Mishnah, where the Mishnah lists all these different episodes in Tanakh that we are either allowed to read with a Meturgaman. A Meturgaman, back in the day, right, like Targum Unkelus, what it originally was used for was that in shul, they would read a pasuk of the Torah, and then somebody would translate it into Aramaic. And then they would read the next verse, and someone would translate it into Aramaic. So if you think shul is slow now, imagine going through each pasuk by pasuk. But the idea was that most people didn't, they were their spoken language was Aramaic, they didn't know Hebrew well, and in order to understand the Parsha, they needed somebody to translate for them. So the Mishnah has this list of things that they should not be translating in shul. Okay, so it says the story of Reuven, this which is when he goes into Bilhah's bed, which is a whole episode in Bereishit Lamed Hey. Nikra v'lo mitargem, right? We should read it, but don't translate it. Maase Tamar, Nikra mitargem. The story with Tamar, it should be read. and interpreted. So you're allowed to translate that one. Maase Egal HaRishon, meaning the way Rashi explains this is the first account that we spoke about, what the Torah tells the events in real time. Nikra u'mitargem, you can read that and translate it. V'hasheni nikra v'lo mitargem. But the second, you can read, but you should not translate it. So Rashi on this Gemara says, why shouldn't you translate the second one? Because the fact that it says that the Egal just appeared means that if there is a Metzurgam, he's a translating word for word, but there's nobody explaining things in depth. And so if you can't have somebody explaining things and there's a uneducated person sitting there and they hear this thing that this Egel just appeared, they may be led to think that it did have some sort of magical supernatural powers to it, and that there was some miraculous thing surrounding this, and the Egel was a good thing and it should have been there, and therefore it should not be read out loud. But what clearly Chazal seemed to be picking up on, the fact that they're distinguishing between the two, is that there's something weird going on with this second accounting that we're not super comfortable with. Otherwise we would say go ahead and translate it, right? So I just thought that was very interesting when I came across this source, to see that Chazal are sensitive to this concern. So if you look, now we're going to look at a bunch of Rashis, and everything Rashi says he basically got from Midrash Tanhuma, but I felt like it would be worthwhile to see it in there. Originally, the source sheet was like three times as long, and all the Tanhumas were in here too, and then I realized that was insane and took them out for you. So if anybody really wants them, I have them on my computer. I can send them to you. Okay, so Be'oznei Nashechem. So this is the first time when Aharon says to them, go and get the jewelry that your wives are wearing, right? Amar Aharon Belibo. Aharon was thinking to himself, Hanashim v'yeladim chasim al tachshitehem. The women and children care about their jewelry. Shema yitakev hadavar. Maybe they will delay the issue. Ubetoch kach yavo Moshe, and during this time Moshe will come. Vehem lo himtinu uparku me'alatzman. But the men didn't wait, and they just took off their own. Okay, so that is Rashi. Now I did give you the Midrash Tanhuma for this one because what's really interesting, and I think this is an interesting example of what Rashi does, is Rashi does almost always use Midrash in his Perush, but he is a Pashtan. He is somebody who's looking for the Pshat. There are hundreds of Midrashim, and he picks the ones that he thinks fit the best in the Pshat of his understanding of the story, but he also will sometimes only select from part of a Midrash. If there's something about the Midrash that he's not comfortable with or doesn't like, he may not explain why, but he won't take that part of the Midrash. So I don't have a good answer for why he didn't bring this part, but I thought it was important to see this Midrash inside. So if you look in Midrash Tanhuma, source number three, he says, I'm going to read it to you in English. Aaron said to them, break off the golden rings, which are in the ears of your wives. Aaron told them to do this difficult thing because he was aware that the women would not agree to it. They'd seen the miracles and the deeds that the Holy One, blessed be He, had wrought for them in Egypt and at the Red Sea and at Sinai. And so they went to the women and they stood up to them and said, God forbid that we should renounce the Holy One, blessed be He, who has performed all these miracles and mighty deeds on our behalf in order to fashion an idol. Since the women didn't listen to them, what is written there, and all the people broke off the golden rings which were in their ears, and it does not say in their wives' ears, but rather in their ears. So this Midrash is picking up again on this language thing, and the Midrash is saying that, right, why didn't the women say yes? The Midrash is saying because they were righteous. Why does Rashi say the women didn't say yes? Because they were materialistic. So I just think it's really interesting. I'm not sure why Rashi went in the direction he went in, but to see that just because something in the R scroll Rashi might write in brackets that Rashi got this from Midrash Tanhuma doesn't mean that that's exactly what the Midrash says. And sometimes when you look at the Midrash, you may see inconsistencies because Rashi's using the ideas of Midrash, but he's making them fit what he believes is what really happened. Okay, so that is the first sort of thing we pointed out about this business of the gold and where the gold came from. If you look at source number four, this is Rashi again. The other Midrash, the rest of this Midrash said, Umesa Aharon, what did Aharon do? He said, let the celebration be delayed until tomorrow, as it said, and Aharon made a proclamation to say, tomorrow shall be the feast of the Lord. So this Midrash in Tanhuma 19, it literally goes through like the whole story and tries to explain to us why Aharon was attempting to basically stall, right? He thought the women would say no, then he tried to push it off till tomorrow, and he's just trying to buy time, hoping that Moshe will show up at any minute, and at that point, they'll sort of stop in their tracks, and they won't continue with what's going on. Okay, so now let's look at this Rashi. So there's a lot in this Rashi, source number four. This is on Pasuk Dalet. So the first question that we have to grapple with is, what is this cheret? So we said before that the R scroll translated as a kerchief, right? That he took all the gold, he gathered it in some sort of cloth. And then what does it say? That he threw it in, or it just sort of...
He threw it
fashioned it into a molten
He fashioned calf. It. Okay, he fashioned it. Okay. So Rashi wants to explain to us two terms here, vayitzar, which usually means to fashion, and the other one is this cheret. So the first, so he's going to give us two explanations of what's going on. Okay, so the first is yesh letargamo bishnei fanim. We have two ways of translating it. Hayachad, vayitzar, lashon kshira. That vayitzar here means to tie up. Becheret is lashon sudar, meaning a cloth or a garment of some kind. Kmo shehamit pachot v'hacharitim, which is from Yeshayahu, which is his textual proof to being able to translate it this way. V'yitzar kikrayim kesef b'shnei charitim in Malachim. V'hashini, and the second translation he gives us, we'll go over them again in a second, is v'yitzar is lashon tzura, to form or to fashion. Becheret is a clay omanut hatzorfin shechortzin v'chortzin bo tzurot b'zahav. It's some sort of like goldsmith tool that they use for engraving and cutting. Okay, hi. Can we pass one more source sheet down here? So what does Rashi say? The first one is that he took some sort of garment, he gathered all the gold and tied it up in there, and then fashioned it into a calf. And the second is that he fashioned, literally, right? He fashioned a calf using this cheret, using this engraver's tool. Now, something that's interesting to realize about this engraver's tool is that what does he say it's for? Engraving. That doesn't really sound like something you would use to fashion, like, the base of a statue. You would think that, like, the statue, you would use some sort of bigger, harder, molding, something or other. And then you would use the engraver to, like, make the details.
Right.
So some of the mafarshim on Rashi here say that perhaps this also was a way of stalling. If Aaron was going to use the inappropriate tool that was going to take twice as long to make the calf, he was just trying to slow down the process. He's like, okay, you want a calf? I'll make you a calf, but I got to do it like this, right? And then so it sort of takes forever for it to be ready. So that's one potential. But usually when Rashi gives two explanations, he's more interested in the first one than the second. And the first one is this business of this kerchief, of it being gathered in a garment. And I think that one would imply to us, again, which sort of fits with what Aharon says later, this more miraculous formation of the calf that took place. That he didn't actually do anything technically physical to make the calf. It somehow just became. Like, he tied it up in a garment. Vayitzar was to tie for Rashi, and the cheret is the garment. He tied the gold up in a garment, and, like, this calf was made. So that would imply, perhaps, that, and that's actually what, sorry, no, Unkelus goes with the second one. So I think Rashi's offering two here because he understands that the first is probably not super believable, and so he's giving the alternative explanation as well. But I think he's bringing the first because he's thinking that maybe that would make sense with what Aharon says. Maybe Aharon's account was true. Maybe something magical did happen. Now, then you would have to argue, well, why would Hashem do that?
Hashem, right.
Right? Okay, so was it Hashem? So let's keep reading what Rashi has to say next. So we're going to skip to where it says, Egel Masecha, a molten calf in the bold. We're in source number 4.
Yeah.
Okay. Kevan Shehishlichu La'ur Bachur, once they sent it into this, like, into the fire, right, in the melting pot, Mechashvei Erev Rav, She'alu imehemi Mitzrayim, Vesa'uhu Bichshafim. Who made it into this golden calf? Who molted it? The magicians of the Erev Rav. Who are the Erev Rav? They are Egyptians who left Egypt with us, who sort of joined forces, sort of converted, but they are usually the scapegoat of Chazal. Right?
Yeah.
Whenever something goes wrong in the desert, it's the fault of the Arab Rav. The Jews didn't do it. It's those guys who insisted on coming with us. And the Midrash actually says, why did the Arab Rav come with us? Because Moshe insisted. Hashem said they shouldn't come, and Moshe begged Hashem to let them come. That's what the Midrash says about this. So it's really interesting, because if that's true, why? That we're going to see this Midrash soon. If Hashem knew what the Erev Rav were capable of doing and how they were going to bring the people down, he was trying to protect the people. But Moshe, in his kind-hearted ways, was like, these people want to join us. They want to do the right thing. They want to do good. How can we say no to them? And he may not have been wrong on a human level, right? Like, sometimes we allow people into our lives because we feel that they mean well, and then we end up being burned for it later, right? And that can sometimes happen. But that's the first explanation he gives of how this magically could have happened is that these magicians, and we know that the Egyptians had very strong, powerful sorcerers in their culture, so that's the first option. Second option, he says, V'yeshom rim, Micha hayashem. Who's Micha? Does anybody know the story of Pesel Micha?
The one who brought up the bones also had something
to okay, he, we're going to talk about this right here. Yeah, so he, Micha is the story in Shoftim. Yeah, I was about, yeah, it's in Shoftim. And it's a story of someone who basically brings an idol, and the idol brings us all down and creates all kinds of problems for the Jewish people. We can go into it later, but that's essentially what who Micha was. But the Midrash says that Micha came from Mitzrayim, and who was he? He was the Midrash talks about the babies who were being killed and that the Egyptians would like sandwich them between the bricks in the buildings. Yeah. And that Moshe was so upset by this that he davened to Hashem that Hashem should stop it, and he was so angry and upset. And so Hashem saved this baby, and this baby turned out to be Micha, who is making the calf, and then he's going to go make this idol and bring the Jewish people down again, which is the Midrash's way of saying that Hashem has his reasons for how things happen. And we can't know those reasons, and we can't understand them. But when Moshe saw this terrible injustice happening and he davened for it, Hashem listened. But ultimately, Hashem had a reason why this neshama was the one that ended up in this fate and not a different one, because he knew where this neshama was destined to go. And he saved it because Moshe asked him to, but had Moshe not davened for this baby, then this person would not have come to be with the Jewish people throughout this history. So again, this is Midrash. It doesn't mean that for sure this is actually what happened, but it's the way that Chazal are using to sort of teach us these lessons and philosophical ideas through the story. But either way, so how did Micha do this? Because Micha hiyasham, shiatzar mitoch dimusei binyan, shenit ma'ech bo mibitzrayim, v'haya b'yado shem v'tas, shekatav bo Moshe, alei shor. So there is this midrash that talks about how did Moshe get Yosef's bones out of the Nile to take with them back to Israel. And he had this special plate that had the name of God written on it, and he used it to get rise the bones to rise up, right? And he said, Ale Shor, which is come up ox, come up ox, which is a reference to Yosef, but it also is like an eagle. So Micha had the plate and used it and said, Ale Shor, and brought this eagle up out of the gold. Okay, so that's what the Midrash is saying. Rashi, again, did not make this up. He got it from the Midrash. So those are two ways that Rashi suggests that it could be that the Egel was fashioned miraculously, but not by God, but by people who were using their divinity in negative ways. Okay? Any questions? Aside from the obvious, like, what are you talking about? This is insanity. What'd you say?
I don't really like it.
Okay, fair. Why not?
Because it doesn't seem like this really happened.
Okay, so... I totally am with you. I struggle a lot with Midrash. I think that it's so hard to know when to like take it seriously and when not to take it seriously. Did Rashi really think this? Did he not really think this? But Rashi is grappling with the question of why is Rashi bringing these Midrashim? He must have a reason. What's his reason? Aaron said the calf appeared. And Aaron can't be lying. So therefore, I need a reason how that could have happened. And so he searches the Midrashim, and this is what he finds. I think that's what Rashi is going with. I find it hard to believe also. However, I do think that there is some room for us to like recognize that there may have been, like we know that kishuf, like sorcery and magicians and all this stuff is something that did exist in ancient times that people used for negative, for positive. The Torah tells us not to do it. And so this concept did exist. So what exactly it was and how it operated is very hard for us to relate to. And I'm a very rational person, so I read this stuff and I just kind of like laugh it off. But I think that there's a part of me that wants to say, like, I need to give it, first of all, Rashi thought to write this, so there must be some value to it. And it could be Rashi was basically...
It doesn't mean it happened.
Does it mean it happened? Not necessarily, but maybe it did, maybe it didn't. I think for Rashi, he's trying to find an explanation for the fact that Aharon felt it was necessary to say that the calf just appeared, right? So that's, I think, where Rashi is going with all of this.
The word masecha, because that's it says masecha every time except when Aaron mentions it and just says egel.
Right. So I did see some stuff about how masecha is related to the word mask. And, but it was like very like Kabbalistic and lofty and made no sense to me. So I was like, I can't teach this. I don't understand what it says. But I can send you the article if you want.
When Egel masecha, maybe he was thinking that it would be like a mask like thing, like
right.
Not real.
Interesting.
It was an egel. It was
right.
A real thing.
Right. So it could be. It does sound like Aharon is telling the story like he was surprised about how things happened. He didn't expect things to go this way, which is, I think, maybe why we don't hold him accountable, because he didn't.
He's not punished.
Right.
Right.
He didn't really seem to like know what was flying somehow.
But maybe also when he's saying, you know, I used this tool that should have slowed things down, and then it still appeared. He's almost like throwing it back at God, like, listen, I tried to stall them.
Right.
You could have helped me along.
100%. Like, at some point, Hashem decides to tell Moshe what's going on. Why does Hashem wait till the Egel is already there and the people are already bowing to it before he reports, right? He could have said, your people are down there. They're talking to Aaron about making a god. Maybe you should get back down there, right? Like, why does Hashem wait and choose? So again, we can't decide for Hashem why he chooses to do what he does, but these are all questions Aaron could have had. Like, why'd you do this to me? Why'd you put me in this position?
Spouses test each other sometimes.
Right.
Well, maybe he won't cheat.
Yeah.
I'll watch here from my car, even though he's going into her house. Like, I'm sure nothing will happen.
Okay, so that is.
Never mind. It just came to mind. A lot of TV last night.
Okay, so that is our crazy Rashi, I would say. And then it says at the last part of Rashi, it says Elo Elokecha, this is your God, or these are your gods. But lo ne'amar ela Elokeinu. It didn't say this is our God. Mikan she'erev Rav she'alumi Mitzrayim hem she'nikaluim ala Haron v'hem she'asa uhu. This is how we know it was the erev Rav, because it says your God. It doesn't say our God. So it must have been outsiders who were speaking to the people, telling them something. And that's where he gets the idea that it must have been the erev Rav who were involved in this, and they were the ones who said all this. Okay, so that is one thing that I saw that was really interesting. I read an article from Rabbi Kahn, and he was speaking about how the fact that the Midrash points to Micha and the heir of Rav shows that Moshe has some fault to play here. Both Midrash both points to Moshe as being at fault for both Micha and the heir of Rav being present. So therefore, somehow Moshe has like a hand in all of this, which is just an interesting thought to have. He's not there, but like somehow maybe he was also somehow responsible for this coming about.
That's why Hashem waited for
maybe
to teach Moshe a lesson.
Right. Okay, so let's look at source number 5. Okay, Shichet Amecha. Shichet Ha'am Lo Ne'amar. It doesn't say the people are corrupt, but rather your people are corrupt. Erevrav, shekibalta me'atzmecha, the Erevrav that you yourself decided to bring here. V'giyartem, and you converted them. V'lo nimlachtabi, and you didn't consult with me. V'amarta tov shidbeku geirim b'shchina, because you thought it would be good for these people to come close to God, right? V'hem shichatu v'hishchitu, but they have basically corrupted themselves and corrupted others. So that's the Midrash again that he's quoting, basically showing that it was Moshe's fault for allowing these people to come, and now they've brought us down.
That's why Aaron wasn't punished.
Right.
Because follows the same trend.
100%. Basically, all the Mefarshim I saw gave Aaron excuses. I didn't see any Mefarshim who were like, Aaron was wrong. They said maybe he shouldn't have done it this way. Maybe his strategy could have been different. But like, nobody thought he was genuinely, maliciously at fault. They were either silent or they were trying to find excuses for him. Well, not excuses in a bad way, but they were trying to figure out how this could be. Okay, so now we are up to source number 6, okay? So which is Rashi on verse 5. V'yar Aharon, shehaya bo ruach chayim. Okay, let's go back for a second. If you look at this pasuk, it said, V'yar Aharon. And then it said, V'yar Aharon, this is pasuk, hey, V'yiven Mizbeach. Aharon saw, and he built a Mizbeach. So what did he see? So from the Peshat, it sounds like he saw the people saying, this is your God. But all the Mefarshim are like, well, there's no like subject of the verb. It says, he saw it, an object of the verb. There's a subject. There's no object. It doesn't say what he saw. So the Mefarshim are all going to go to town. What did Aharon see? Okay? So V'yar Aharon, Shehiyabo Rochaim, he saw that the calf basically came to life. Shne'emar, but Tavnit Shor Ochel Esev, that it was like this, it like ate grass. This is a quote from Tehillim where it's talking about the Egel, and it says that it looked like a shore that could eat. So it was moving around. It had some sort of like vitality to it. V'ra'av hitzliach ma'aseh satan, v'loha yalo peh lichotam legamre. He realized that the satan's work had succeeded, so he had no way of arguing against them. If the calf somehow has this miraculous look to it, and it's moving, and it's doing, and it's whatever, how are you supposed to turn around and tell these people, no, you're not supposed to be worshiping this thing. Like, this was a mistake. This is wrong. Like, look at this thing. It's like Hashem must want us to be doing this. Look at it moving, talking to us, moving around. So this idea of seeing it alive, V'yar Aharon, that Midrash is basically trying to explain why he didn't keep trying to stop them from what they were doing. V'yiven Mizbeach, why did he build this altar? Lid Chotam, to push them off. V'yikra Chag LaHashem Machar. And he called out, there will be a holiday for Hashem tomorrow. V'lo Hayom, right, and not today. Shema Yavo Moshe Kodem Shia Avduhu, because maybe Moshe will come before they worship it. Zehu Pshuto, that's the pshat. Umidrash show, and the Midrash says, Bevayikra Rabba, Tzvarim Harbe Aharon. Aharon saw many things. So what did he see? So now he's going to give us three different things that Aharon saw. The first one, this is a famous one, Ra'a Chur ben Achoto, Shehayam Ochicham Veharaguhu. He saw Chur, his nephew, who had tried to stop the people, and what did they do to him?
Killed him.
Okay, so that might be one of the reasons why Aharon didn't stand up to them, okay? So the question you could ask on that is, if Avodah Zarah is one of the three big cardinal sins that you're supposed to die for, then, like, did Aharon make the right decision? Well, if you go with Ramban, you say it wasn't Avodah Zarah, then you don't have a problem. But Rashi thinks it is Avodah Zarah, and he's the one quoting it, so you have to question about that excuse. Vizehu vayiven mizbeach lefanav. He's going to have an answer. I'll show it to you in a minute. And what does it mean when it says that he built this mizbeach before him? He says, no, the nekudot are wrong. What should it rather say? Vayaven mizavuach lefanav. He understood that he had been sacrificed before him. So viyar Aharon vayiven mizbeach lefanav. The Midrash reads as, Aharon saw and he understood that Hur had been sacrificed, meaning killed. Okay, before him. That's like the Midrashic read on the Pasuk. Ve'od ra'a ve'amar, and he also saw mutav shita lebi haserachon ve'lo behem. It would be better that I be held responsible for this sin than them. So I'm going to get involved and try to hold it off and whatever, but at least then it'll be on me and the Jewish people won't be destroyed because of what they did, because it'll be my fault. So he was actually doing it selflessly. He was trying to protect the people. That's the next thing. And the third thing that the Midrash says that he saw, he saw and realized that if they build the Mizbeach, this guy's going to bring this rock, this guy's going to bring that rock. They're going to, if they're all working together, they could build this thing in 20 minutes. It's going to be so quick. But if I say that I'm the one who has to build it, right? Their work will be done very quickly. If I build it, and I have to do it all by myself, while I'm building it, it'll take so much longer if I'm working by myself, and then Moshe will arrive while I'm busy doing it. So that's another way of showing that Aharon was trying to stall them, right? And then this Chag LaHashem, Rashi says, what does Chag LaHashem mean? Abilibo haya l'shamayim, in his heart, it was for Hashem. Batuach hayash yavo Moshe via avidu atamakom. He was sure that Moshe would arrive and then they would worship Hashem. So that's why he's saying Chag LaHashem machar, because it really, at the end of the day, Aharon's intention was always for Hashem. He was trying to save the situation, had no other choices, and that's how Rashi understands Aharon. One final Rashi. When Moshe approaches Aharon and says to him, what did this nation do to you? He says, Ma salecha ha'am. And then, so how does Rashi explain that? Kama yisirim savalta, shiisrucha ad shelo tavi aleim chetzeh. He said, they must have inflicted suffering upon you. Like, they must have basically forced you into this. Like, what did they do to you to get you to agree to this? They must have done something so terrible. Because Moshe's basic understanding is that Aharon must not have actually been responsible. He must have somehow been coerced into this and had no other choice. So that's Rashi's view of the situation. Any questions on Rashi? Great. Okay, let's look at Chizkuni. He's quick. Source number 8. Chizkuni says, he's talking a bit about, again, back to the beginning. This is his commentary on the first sort of section there. And he says, Parkuni's Me'ezahav, Aharon l'shem shemayim nidkaven, right? Aharon was, his intentions were really for the heavens, meaning for Hashem. Chashav bilibo, he thought in his heart, imo mer lahem l'ha'amid aleihem echad min hagdolim, l'mekhar k'shivo Moshe lo yirtzel aredet migdulato. If I appoint somebody else as a leader, tomorrow when Moshe comes back, that person's not going to want to step down. V'tzarbek tatzav v'shvichut damim b'nehem, and it's going to cause like a civil war in the Jewish people, because now there's going to be two leaders and everybody's going to be split about who they want to go with. Do they want to go with this guy or do they want to go with Moshe? So he doesn't think it's a good idea to try to suggest to them a different leader. Again, the Chizkuni is one of the people who thinks that the whole point of the Egel was to replace Moshe, not to replace Hashem. So he's trying to explain why Aharon didn't just say to them, oh, you're worried about Moshe? Okay, so I'll be your leader, or this guy can be your leader. Let's just choose somebody else to be our new leader, and then we'll all be okay. So that's the reason why he doesn't choose somebody else. V'im lo amid lahem, hem ya amiduhu me'atzmam. And if I don't appoint someone, they're going to appoint someone themselves, and then there's going to be even more machloket, because they're going to all be fighting amongst themselves who should be appointed as this new leader. If I say, I'll be your leader, this will upset Moshe. Asika b'dvarim, I'll just busy myself with things, ad shivo Moshe, until Moshe comes, ve'aseh dvar she'ein bo mamashut. I will just do something that has like no substance to it. I'll just busy myself and try to stall the situation, because she'yavo Moshe, yivetel me'alav v'chein nasa. And when Moshe comes, it'll all be nullified, it'll all be over with, and that's what he did. And he says, and that's why he told them to go and get their wives' jewelry, as Rashi explained, because he thought that that would be the first step to sort of stalling them off. Okay, so that's Chiz Kuni. So he is, because Rashi views the Egel, as we spoke last week, as Avodah Zarah. So his explanations of how Aaron stalled are all going to be surrounding that. Chiz Kuni views the Egel's role as being there to create a new leader for the Jewish people. So for Chiz Kuni, he's going to explain why didn't Aaron just offer them an alternative leader? Like, it wouldn't be in any way controversial, in theory, if he would have just said, you know what, we don't know where Moshe is, let's just have an interim president, right? Like, let's just elect someone else in the meantime until Moshe gets back to sort of help us feel more comfortable here. And then nobody could look at it and be like, are they doing a Avodah Zarah? Like, that wouldn't have looked bad at all. Why didn't he just do that? So Chiz Kuni is giving the inside Aaron's mind of why it would be that they couldn't solve the problem that way. Any thoughts? Okay. Yeah. No, you read this and you like, he talked about like, oh, this could cause strife and this could cause strife, and it's like, he's true, like, he's totally right. Like, no matter where you cut it, whenever there's like a vacuum in leadership, like, it generally doesn't end up well for anybody. Okay, source number 9. I'm sorry I put some sideways, I just couldn't bring myself to photocopy another page. Mm-hmm. So this is from Rav Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch, we spoke about it before, but we'll read him inside because I love him. So here's what he has to say. So he gives a whole little essay. He writes on verses 2 to 4, like all together in one sort of section. I didn't give it all to you, but I gave you this part that specifically deals with Aaron. But he also speaks very interestingly, if anybody wants to look it up, he talks about why a cow and not something else, which was sort of interesting. Okay, as already noted on verse 1, the implication of verses 1 and 35 is that Aharon acted under the coercive pressure of a powerful mob, right? The verse 35 is where it says, Asher Asa Aharon, that Aharon made this calf. In Devarim 9:20, it explicitly says that Aharon committed a serious sin. He should have opposed the people in word and in deed, even at the risk of his life. He thought, however, that it was prudent and therefore proper to yield to the people for their own sake. This is how his actions have always been explained. Aaron reasoned that if he were to fall victim to the people, they would throw off all restraint and give themselves up to their folly all the more. In fact, Hur, who was left at Aaron's side to assist him, is never heard from again, which leads some to suggest that he attempted to oppose the people and paid for it with his life. It was natural for Aaron to believe that, by taking control of the events, he would be able to stall by means of a slowdown until Moshe's return, and that in any case, he would be able to limit the scale of the people's sin. There is support for this interpretation throughout the episode. Aaron demands of the people, take off your gold rings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters. He expects that the women and children will not so easily or quickly allow themselves to be deprived of their jewelry. Hence the expression parak, which always denotes a separation that can be accomplished only by considerable effort. So I think this is really interesting. It doesn't say vayaser, like vayaser, which is to remove. Perek, right, like division, chapter division, is the same shoresh here. And he tells them to remove their jewelry with a verb that Rav Hirsch is saying, like, he was hoping it was going to be hard for them. He was hoping that it was going to be a really difficult decision whether they wanted to give up their prized possessions for the sake of this idol, and that perhaps they wouldn't be so willing to part with it. And if they wouldn't be willing to part with it, and it was a hard decision to make, maybe he'd be able to lead them in a different direction. Thus, too, we're on the sideways one now. Verse 4, V'yitzara tobecheret, instead of casting the gold into a mold, a process that would have concluded quickly, he melted the gold into one mass, v'ashlechehu ba'esh, he threw it into the fire, and then carved it, slowly producing the shape which could have been oriented quickly by casting. Cheret, related to charat, always denotes a writing tool for engraving, a stylus, which is the second interpretation that Rashi gave, right? He gives a Yeshayahu, which is what, I think it's the same verse that Rashi quoted. Thus, Aaron chose a weak instrument which would do the work in the slowest possible manner. Right? So for Rav Hirsch, again, this is also all about, it's like a delay tactic, right? Everything Aaron's doing is to try to delay things. He then goes on to say, I'm sorry, I didn't bring it for you, that ultimately things got out of hand. And as much as he tried to delay things, they kept speeding up. And the people were just so excited and passionate about this that he couldn't really hold them off and he couldn't slow them down. And ultimately, they got ahead of him. And by the time Moshe got there, it was sort of like had spiraled out of his control. But his goal was all along to sort of slow things down. And then the final source that I brought for you, I can't believe we actually saw everything inside. I thought it would take me way longer. This is from Rabbi Golden's book, Unlocking the Torah Text. He has a whole thing on Aaron, which is where I got a lot of my sources from today. He like goes through different, if anybody hasn't used his book before, it's excellent. He basically presents a question and then gives a bunch of different approaches and then gives his own sort of like nice little vort at the end. I think a lot of what he puts in his book were his drushas in his shul. And he goes through all these different approaches, the Rashi and then Rav Hirsch and the Chizkuni, and how they all sort of, they all have a similar theme to them, but they all sort of approach it in slightly different ways using the language of the text to figure out how to explain Aharon's actions. But he says something really interesting. I touched on it last week, but I think it's genius. So he says, Aaron is a behavioral photographic negative of his brother. Whereas Moshe is direct and blunt, almost to the point of being undiplomatic, Aaron is a soft compromiser who desires nothing more than harmony within the nation, right? Aaron is famous for being Ohev Shalom, Verodev Shalom, right? He's sort of the peacemaker of the people, and that's not necessarily Moshe's strong point, and they sort of balance each other out. They're sort of a team for a reason. Whereas Moshe sometimes lacks in the patience and the ability to deal with that, and he's sort of like a justice seeker. So if he sees something wrong, he wants to deal with it, like when he kills the Egyptian, right? That's something that Aaron probably would not have done, because he doesn't have that strength of character to really stand up for what's right, because he's like an appeaser. Whereas Moshe has this like strong sense of justice, which is a great thing, but also can sometimes be a little dangerous. So they sort of balance each other out. How telling that the failures of each of these brothers will take place at the extremes of their personalities. Moshe will lose his leadership at Mei Meriva, where, moved to anger by the people's demand for water, he will strike a rock rather than fulfill God's command by speaking to it. Aaron's low point of leadership occurs here at the foot of Sinai, as the great compromiser compromises once too often. We cannot excuse Aaron's behavior, but given his personality, we can understand. So I think this is like amazing, because all the other Mefarshim are like, oh, he didn't really do it, or he did it, but he didn't mean to do it, and it happened, and Rabbi Golden's like, listen, like at the end of the day, especially if you think that the idol, if you think that the Egel was an idol, even saying like, oh, I saw Hur was killed, so what else was I supposed to do? But like, no, like for idol worship, you let yourself be killed. Like, you don't allow yourself to go down that road. And he's basically saying, I think that the Torah is holding him accountable, and just because he wasn't punished doesn't mean the Torah is not holding him accountable. He may not have intended for it to go this way. He may have been trying to stall them, but ultimately, if he would have had a bit of more of a backbone, then perhaps he would have been able to stop them in a much more serious way. But because he is the type to, like a yes man, right? He's the type to say yes. He ultimately, and again, it's so interesting, and I was surprised nobody raised their hand, but when Rashi points out that Moshe comes to Aaron and says to him, what did they do to you? They must have really hurt you to make you do this. And like, when you read the Psukim, he didn't do anything. They were like, let's do this. And he's like, all right, go get your gold. Like, he doesn't even seem to try to slow them down. Like, it's true, the way, if you read it carefully, maybe he is slowing them down. Maybe there are delay tactics going on. But really, if you read the pshat, it just sounds like he's kind of going along with the ride of what the Jewish people are doing. And it's hard to understand, but what Rabbi Golden is saying is like, it makes perfect sense if you think about the bigger picture of who Aharon was, that he was trying to do his best based on the skills he had. He didn't have it in him to like stand up on his soapbox and yell and scream until they all listened to him, because that's not who he was. If Moshe would have been there, he would have just hit something with his stick or something, right? And gotten like sort of startled them and gotten them to pay attention. But Aaron didn't have Moshe there to hit the rock. He himself, this was the best he could do. So I think that's sort of really interesting when we think about leadership, and you can't separate who a person is from their leadership, right? How a person chooses to lead the people has everything to do with what character traits they possess. And sometimes some character traits are like possible to sort of acquire and build on and work with, but some are just natural, like who you are. And Aaron is a peaceful person. That's who he is. So it makes total sense that he sort of got dragged into this and wasn't able to stop himself. This is the conclusion that Rabbi Golden gives, and I just thought it was really meaningful. When all is said and done, the issue of Aaron's involvement in the Chet Egel is one of those cases where the questions are better than the answers. In such circumstances, we are challenged to continue to search for understanding, even as we acknowledge that we may never know the real truth until God sees fit to reveal it. So he's sort of just ending it off with saying, like, too bad. But in a really nice, eloquent way. Does anybody have any questions, comments?
I just have a couple.
Yeah.
Something you read earlier just said that we, the Jewish people, have a tendency to be evil or bad or something.
In the Pasuk, when Moshe comes to Aaron and he says to him, what happened? How did you let this happen? He says, you know that the Jewish people, you know these people are bera, it says, in evil. But the way they translate it was a tendency to do evil, I think, or something like that.
So, commentaries on that?
A little bit. It's basically like most of the commentaries that I saw basically said like they came from Egypt. They haven't been out of there for so long. This is what they know. So that could be what he meant, or he could have meant something more. I mean, again, this is coming right after they got the Torah, but right before the Torah was, we spoke about last week in Parsha B'Shalach, we had that chiasm where they basically end up where they started off, that they have the they complain about water, then they have a war with an enemy, then they had the something else about complaining about food, then they had a war with an enemy, and then they complained about water again. And that the sort of message of that chiasm, that by the end of the Parsha, like, they're right back where they started. They're just as, you know, like, they haven't developed at all. And that ultimately, they really haven't been out of Egypt for very long, and they haven't yet shown that they're capable of, like, sort of rising to the challenge. And so it could be that that's what Aharon is referring to, or he could just be referring to where they're coming from and all they know. But it is an interesting choice of language that it says evil as opposed to something else a little bit less.
It sounds bira, like, almost as... You're in a state, Moshe. I couldn't snap them out.
Right.
Of it, which
yeah.
doesn't mean that they're always evil. Just mm-hmm. they got so wrapped up in this.
They were just
no
like
them back.
Right. Yeah. Which is exactly how Rav Hirsch explains it. That it was like just this snowball going down the mountain. That there was just no way of getting ahead of it. Like there was just nothing you could do.
Was Aaron respected after this episode by the people?
It's a good question. I guess
they mourned him. Like they did.
They definitely mourned him. That's for sure true.
They know that.
For sure not by Korach. but I guess we would have to like look super carefully at every time he comes up in the text and like the verbs that are used around him. I've never really thought about that question before. It's a really interesting question. Yeah. It's a good question. My natural instinct is to say yeah, because he was the Kohen Gadol, and it doesn't like sound, aside from Korach, but Korach was rebelling. It wasn't really
both
about Aaron. He was just, yeah, he was just upset about, in general, the whole
but
concept of...
You know, because, like, it's a failed... I mean, at least to the Jews, it must have seemed like a failed...
Leadership.
And failed leadership, so then I would imagine that they would...
Right. Like, I can imagine myself as a Jew being like, Aaron, how could you let us do this? Why didn't you stop us? But you... you make a mistake in life, right? But when someone makes a mistake in life and they'll turn to their friends or loved ones afterwards and be like, how did you not, like... And people will be like, we tried to tell you it was coming. You just couldn't see it, right? Like, when you're in it, it's very easy afterwards to blame somebody else for not warning you. But while you're in it, you can't hear.
But they could say, like, on the opposite, like, you helped us.
Right.
Like,
you enabled us.
Or, on the other side, maybe they could still be feeling bitter about this, and they're like, you were on our side, and then you flipped when Moshe came down. Like,
right.
I just... It seems like...
Aaron wasn't really chosen for his leadership skills. He was chosen to help Moshe translate
right.
with his speech. So
right. The fact that he's chosen as the Kohen Gadol means that he himself has something. And I think it makes sense. This Ohev Shalom, Rodef Shalom works perfectly with the Kohen Gadol position as opposed to the political leadership. Like, a Kohen Gadol is not supposed to be the political leader. Those are not the same thing, and there's a reason for that. But he
failed in the religious sector.
Exactly, which is why it's so shocking that he's the Kohen Gadol, which is why I think the Mefarshim are driven to say that there must be something going on here, that everything was really okay with what he did, because otherwise, how could you explain it? Even if you want to say that he was wrong, whatever, like, ultimately, like, Hashem could have chosen any of the Jewish people to decide to be kahuna and, like, for it to come from them, right? And he chose Aharon, so...
If he wasn't just a peacemaker, you probably all have friends who, when they're with you, they say one thing, when there's another friend, they say something else. They just go with the crowd. They don't have, like...
Right.
Their own decision.
That's what he sounds like in this episode, 100%.
You know what? That's kind of what how you interpreted Rabbi Golden, but I think it could be a little different. That,
okay.
That it wasn't necessarily that it didn't have backbone, that Aaron's strength was keeping unity, and that in this instance, he almost may have seen it as, it's better that they be united.
That's the Chizkuni. That's really interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
And he didn't necessarily, he wasn't necessarily weak. He was using his strength. It may have been the wrong choice, but not because he was weak, because he was misguided, the same way Moshe was misguided at other times in his life, but thought he was doing the right thing, and that's his quality, unity.
That's
so
really interesting.
Maybe he's
I like that a lot.
He's being Aaron, but not in a weak way, in a very strong way.
That's really interesting.
Just the wrong way.
Right. Exactly. But then the question is, so maybe that was his goal, but ultimately Hashem is clearly unhappy with what's going on, and Hashem sends the Levium to kill everyone, sends the plague, and Moshe makes them all drink the ground up agal. Like, there's clearly, the response is bad, right? So the question is, again, just like how we had the question last week of what was Bnei Israel's intention, we know how Hashem felt about it, but does that mean that that's what they intended or not what they intended? Those are, like, you know, sort of the question, like, what's Aaron's intention here? But I really like that, like, with the Chizkuni, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.